This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, welcome to the show. This is Emotional Badass, where Moxie meets Mindful. I'm your host, Nikki Eisenhower, life coach and psychotherapist. And on today's episode, I'm exploring understanding highly sensitive people. People who are glaringly highly sensitive to me often ask me with great doubt if I really think they are highly sensitive. From Dr. Elaine Aron's work, she's published multiple books now on highly sensitive people. Highly sensitive children, highly sensitive people in relationship. From her work and research, we estimate that highly sensitive people are 15 to 20% of the population. Those numbers have never meant a whole lot to me or my clients until it occurred to me one day to flip them. This statistic means that 80 to 85% of people are normies. They're not HSPs like me. This means that we who are highly sensitive have had feedback, guidance, reactions, judgment, observations and expectations, even counseling and medical care from many, many people who are wired very, very differently than we are. Another way for me to say it is we've gotten a hell of a lot of feedback from people about who we are, how we should be, that we're weird or strange or wrong in how we process, experience, and react to the world. This is alienating. It's confusing. This makes us feel broken, confused, lost, even anxious and depressed. This messaging often boils down to, hey, highly sensitive person, you just shouldn't be highly sensitive. We can't change high sensitivity like we can't change skin tone. We can't change the size of our feet. We can't change our eye color. We just can't. So don't waste your time trying not to be highly sensitive if you are. I hope today's episode helps you understand and embrace sensitivity as a superpower for yourself or for someone you love. We can categorize the characteristics and experiences of highly sensitive people, that's HSPs, into some key concepts and categories. This organization can help you understand if you are highly sensitive and how to appreciate the strengths of your sensitivity while also managing its challenges. I like to say that there's a beauty and a burden to high sensitivity, and I have intended this show to lighten that burden with compassion, acceptance, respect, and useful tools and strategies to embrace our sensitivity. Many sensitive people mistakenly go out into the world with a sense of desperation, wanting the world to accept them and their differences. And then, after the world accepts us, then we'll give ourselves permission to accept ourselves. That never works. It won't work. The respect has to come from your own self-acceptance, your own self-worth. It's not other acceptance. It's not other work. It's not other worth. It's not other esteem. And accepting who we really are, walking the earth as a sort of individual ambassador of our sensitivity instead of apologizing for it. When you know how to lean in with self-respect, the world and its people gets in alignment with your powerful ownership and self-regard of who you are. This is how we learn to feel and garner respect in our lives and in our circles. There are two schools of thought about what creates or makes for high sensitivity in a human being. One is that highly sensitive people are born. The other is that we are made by trauma. Now, I subscribe to both. I was both born highly sensitive, and I can look back at my early memories and I can see these traits in myself. I can look back as young as 3 years old when my sister came home from the hospital, and the way that I processed her homecoming just tracks in a highly sensitive way. It's not or, it's and. My childhood chaos and neglect and trauma increased my sensitivity. There are professionals who will argue that we are not born, that all of our sensitivity only comes from trauma. I can't direct you to studies that prove or disprove either way, but I can tell you that I have had hundreds of people come back to work with me for almost 2 decades, which means that I have had the blessing to witness children untraumatized born to my clients while they're doing great work on themselves in very stable homes with very intentional parenting, showing signs of high sensitivity since birth, very early in life. And these traits seem to track through hitting adulthood. I've been able to see and witness and hear feedback from my clients about their children making it all the way out of high school or into college or into marriage and into having children of their own. I very much believe that we are both born and made more sensitive. Here are the categories with the associated concepts for today's episode that I'm focusing on. And I'm focusing on these as a foundation of understanding what high sensitivity is. We're going to explore this high sensitivity, and you're going to hear me mention terms like high sensation seeking, maybe even empaths. It's a very popular word now. You've probably heard it. All these are different types of sensitivity. I happen to be both high sensation seeking and an empath. Every high sensation seeker and every empath is a highly sensitive person. Every highly sensitive person is not necessarily high sensation seeking or an empath. An important note I want to make before we dive more deeply into this is that these are terms that are overused by people now. And they're overused by people that I would not categorize as even close to being a highly sensitive person. I want you to also know that it's popular right now for people on the narcissistic spectrum, which is another therapeutic word, a diagnostic criteria that is overused, but is legitimately an area of my expertise. But people on the narcissistic spectrum, they love to call themselves highly sensitive right now, particularly women who happen to fall on that narc spectrum. It's important to know that. The more you know, the more that you can navigate yourself wisely and strategically within your own self, but also in dealing with personalities that you meet along the path of life. There is, of course, overlap amongst these categories, and I promise to do my best to help you make simple sense of these concepts in the quest to love yourself and take care of yourself. I've got 6 categories for you. 1, sensory processing sensitivity. 2, emotional reactivity and empathy. 3, a need for downtime. 4, sensory dislikes and avoidance strategies. 5, performance and social interaction. And 6, a context of personal history. So let's break this down. Sensory processing sensitivity. So this is also considered a disorder now. Many children will get this label. Now, as a clinician in the field, I very much resist thinking about 15 to 20% of the population as disordered. But I understand why the average person would see us as disordered. We're not like they are. And from their vantage point, watching us emote, watching us have a hard time sometimes can very much look disordered. You make your choices about how to best consider yourself. Does it help or hurt to think of high sensitivity as a temperament with personality traits or more of a disorder? So simply what this means is that we're easily overwhelmed by strong sensory input. Now, the average nervous system can be easily overwhelmed by strong sensory input. Highly sensitive people, just more so. What's happening online and with youth in our Western culture is a lot of over-focusing, overthinking, even obsessing about emotional feeling. I'll get to emotional feeling in a bit. But for now, I want you to consider the difference between emotion, happy, sad, angry, and what it is to feel emotion versus sense your environment through your bodily sensory system. Think about what we sense if we walk into a room where someone's being funny and light and getting laughs. What do you sense? Do you automatically smile a little bit? Do you feel light? What happens in the pit of your stomach? What do you hear sensorially within a scene of someone being funny and light versus what we might sense if we walk into a room after someone's had a heated argument? We tend to describe that as a chilliness. That's not really about the temperature, right? It's about the energy in that room. We don't feel so comfortable in that energy. What are we sensing when we walk into that room after a heated argument? There's a charge to the air, and as sensitive people, we can very much pick that up. And we have been likely all of our lives if we were born into our high sensitivity. We sense the environment. We sense the energies of people, animals, even the weather. We're aware of subtleties in any environment. My body feels if someone lies. I can feel the subtlety of what may change, whether that's inside of their chemistry, whether that's in their voice, their delivery, the way their eyes might flick around versus settling on a point. Now, it's important to not be cocky or arrogant with our sensitivities. That'll bring us into bad mental health territory. When cocky or an arrogant vibe is added to a sensitive person, that person can overpower, can use, can abuse others, or manipulate knowingly or unknowingly, and give so much weight to their emotions that they really can become disordered with depression or martyrdom, or even walk towards developing a personality disorder. Now, because I can confidently say I'm not cocky or arrogant with my sensitive gifts, I intentionally stay grounded and humble. It means that I very much hold that this is an imperfect gift, not some kind of narcissistic gift. It's an imperfect gift. And perfection is not available. So that means that I hold at the forefront of my mind that I do miss some lies. I do sometimes suspect a lie and am wrong. But overwhelmingly, my sense of truth has been proven on the money, on the ball, so much that people close to me in my life will ask me if I picked up any subtleties that they missed or what my gut response was to something that we may have witnessed or experienced. Earlier in my career, in my first counseling job, my treatment team started figuring out that I had a really good sense, even though they couldn't clinically argue why, about what kind of abuse was going into a family system, because I was the person who would often meet the family members because I ran the family addiction and trauma group. Now, there are pros and cons of awareness of subtlety. because we are observing almost constantly and we are observing so much information. The tilt of a head, the movement of a hand, the way the air changes depending on someone's mood, the lighting, the breeze, the noise from outside of that room, tension, maybe even feeling competition from others or insecurity from others or manipulation and untrustworthiness. This can be very valuable, especially when we have tools to manage it. But without those tools, it's often exhausting, not just at the mental level, at the physical nervous system level of all of the information that our bodies are taking in, so much more than that 80 to 85% of the average person. We can exhaust ourselves. We can overthink. We can overprocess. Because we can observe so much how things could be, even how things should be, which I don't suggest shoulding, it's part of why we struggle with perfectionism. Because we can observe all the little ways of imperfection and want to correct them. Because we can observe how others feel, this really influences our propensity for people-pleasing and codependency. Because if we have a lot of compassion, which we tend to as highly sensitive people, then it makes sense, especially in our little kid logic, our idealism of youth, that we could just help people feel so perfect and then they would never have to be upset. Isn't that great? Can't you hear the innocence, the idealism in that? It's why so many highly sensitive people are drawn to therapy, not just because we're struggling with our sensitivity, but because we're burning ourselves up and out, trying to live an idealized life, a perfect kind of existence that just isn't real or available. We can be very, very sensitive to pain, physical pain or emotional pain. Now, I am also a high sensation seeker. This can be very, very confusing because it seems like I am a conglomerate of opposites. Sensitive people could find themselves highly sensitive to caffeine, getting edgy, not being able to sleep at night. My high sensation seeking part seems to take care of the caffeine. While I definitely can feel an edginess, I am not hypersensitive to caffeine and could drink quite a lot. Bright lights, strong smells, coarse fabrics, loud noises. Our senses are sight, our hearing, touch, taste, smell. As sensitive people, we all will have a different combination of particular sensitivities. Smells and lights really, really bother me, as do fabrics that are unnatural and my skin doesn't like. Loud noises can certainly make me startle. The more that we know and bring a sense of curiosity to our sensory experience, the more we can learn what we need to limit to help ourselves live with more balance, more ease, more peace, without overstimulating or frying our own systems and lives. Highly sensitive people can be very uncomfortable in chaotic or intensely stimulating environments. Part of how my sensitivity worked as a child, growing up with unsafe parents, is that it informed my body to disassociate, to leave the present moment when I was getting abused sexually as a child. Which is, I think, a pretty obvious moment when a survivor of such abuse would want to dissociate. It makes sense that my body would do that, since that's something that is available to happen in the human condition. It may also be part of why my memories were repressed from me, from such a sense of overstimulation. It's as if my consciousness couldn't or wouldn't encode the memories, whereas my siblings, that I would make the argument, I think they would agree, are in some ways less sensitive. I am more sensitive than they are, though they have sensitivity in certain ways too. I am the most sensitive in my family. Their memories were not repressed. This helped me to leave what was abusive and harsh in my mind. It helped me survive. It was part of my survival mode. This is also a symptom of post-traumatic stress. there most certainly is a line that's impossible for me to draw, but most certainly a line between my high sensitivity helping me and then my high sensitivity over-responding into the development of that post-traumatic stress. The problem with dissociation when it wasn't helping me out is that once the body and mind learns dissociation, it's like a path in the woods that is more clearly defined. It's easier for a brain body to walk that dissociative path, to reignite that dissociative process, which sort of means for a long time in my life, I had an easy tripwire into dissociating. Not just at times that were abusive or scary or frightening or overstimulating, at times when I really needed to stay present. Maybe like a boss giving me right and reasonable critical feedback. I've worked almost 2 decades now on how to teach my body safety, peace, in respect of this highly sensitive mind and body, so that I could be able to learn how to control staying present from my wise woman instead of letting my fear centers or my inner child or my critical voice control whether or not I was to be present in that moment. All right, the next category. We just left sensory experience. Now we're going to talk about emotional reactivity and empathy. Highly sensitive people, we are affected by other people's moods. And that's tricky, right? Psychology teaches us that we don't feel anything because of somebody else. We feel things because of ourselves. This has been very confusing for highly sensitive people working with therapists that don't understand sensitivity. We are sensitive like a weather vane that moves in the wind. We are affected by other people because our sensory system is highly aware of what other people are feeling, what their mood is. We can understand this from the lens of being born with sensitivity, but we can also understand this in terms of a trauma response. I learned to be hyper aware and hypersensitive to try to gauge what kind of mood my mother was. Sometimes she'd laugh and find me funny. Sometimes one word that I said would set her off and she'd punch a wall. We need tools to learn how to be less emotionally affected by others, something that is quite impossible as a baby and a small child, because we know, science has proven, that we don't have the stuff in mind or body or maturity yet to self-regulate. We regulate as little babies and small children by feeling the feelings of our mothers, by feeling the feelings of our fathers and aligning with those feelings. That's what informs our nervous system. If our mothers are anxious, we will feel that. If our mothers are giving us energy that you are safe, I am capable, I am in control, relax, sweet baby, then our systems align with those feelings. We need tools to learn how to be less emotionally affected by others, not just the bad in others, not just the difficult in others, but the good too. This is a big underlining current in codependency development. If I don't know how to feel positive and hold on to my positivity within myself, then that makes me very vulnerable to only being able to feel good, everything that that means. Positive, light, optimistic. If somebody around me is feeling that, that's a powerless life position to live in. It's part of why I do this show. It breaks my heart to think that someone would think that that's okay or that's right or would just stay in that powerlessness without ever hearing someone say to them, hey, you can do better than that for yourself. You can learn to hold on to your own great feelings. You can learn to build into your own awesome, lovely, light, beautiful feelings. You're not just like a pinata in other people's moods and emotions. You count and you matter, and you deserve to learn what it is to do that work. That's self-care. Screw bubble baths. This is real, deep, foundational self-care. Emotionally, we're deeply moved by the arts or music. I mean, what an exceptional quality to have as a human being. I can catch myself out of joy, tearfully crying, because some random person I see in the store, their baby smiles. I grew up with my grandmother saying, we make sweet eyes. Babies make sweet eyes. They blink and look at you. Some sweet little baby out there just making sweet eyes at me. It's like all the beauty of the world is in that little child's expression to me. The fact that I can feel that way from the simplicity of a baby smiling, baby I don't even know, what is more beautiful than that? With tools to manage what is burdensome in our sensitivity, y'all, we make space for more of the joy.
Have you ever wished that you had a direct line to your pediatrician to ask them all the questions that constantly crop up while parenting? Well, we hear you, and we have been there too. That's why we launched the Bites of Health podcast. Every morning, we'll answer a commonly asked pediatric question in 5 minutes or less. You can tune in while you're making your second cup of coffee or from the school drop-off line. Who are we? I'm Dr. Jess Steyer, a public health scientist and also co-host of the Unbiased Science podcast. Every day, I'll chat with one or both of your new pediatrician besties, Dr. Dina DiMaggio, a general pediatrician, and Dr. Anthony Porto, a pediatric gastroenterologist. We'll talk about all the things related to our kids' health, from dealing with a colicky infant to navigating puberty in the teenage years. So be sure to tune in to Bites of Health, now live on all podcast platforms.
Now, this is one of my favorites, and this shocks a lot of people. We are highly conscientious as highly sensitive people. Now, why? What a weird thing for me to be able to say, right? Why would we be conscientious? Well, because we observe so much. It means we observe and always have what makes other people feel good, what makes ourselves feel good. We also observe what makes us feel bad. So this lends us to grow more conscientious. I notice if someone rubs their arms and they're in my house, like they're a little bit cold. And that prompts me to act because I so enjoy feeling comforted and comfortable that as a gift, as an act of service, I love being able to help another person feel just a little bit more comfortable. So much is hard in this life. To be able to sense, notice, and then help provide what can make myself or someone else just a little bit more comfortable in a moment of life, that's another layer of beauty to me. So we're often conscientious. Now, this is also another way to take care of ourselves. What do I mean by that? I said earlier that people on the narcissist spectrum are grabbing this highly sensitive term. It's a great manipulation. Looking for conscientiousness, this is a great way to understand the difference between the real deal highly sensitive people and the ones on the narcissism spectrum faking it. Now, a narcissist might be able to fake conscientiousness for a little short period of time, but it does not last and it is not pervasive in their personality because it's not real, it's phony. So use your beautiful, sensitive, observational skills to look, to sense, and trust what you see and sense. Trust what you feel in your heart, your gut, your body, over your mind processing their words, like them standing in front of you, telling you that they're highly sensitive, but they're not showing you that they are highly sensitive if they aren't very conscientious. Now, we all have rude moments. We all drop the ball. We all miss something important. It's in the pervasive pattern of what a person shows, how they present, how they show up, how they own themselves, how they don't. We are also easily startled. And this can be really confusing for trauma survivors like me because I have the layer of being easily startled from my high sensitivity that I believe was natural. But also, there's a startle response as a very specific symptom of real post-traumatic stress. So I had a double whammy of startle response. I've had friends over the course of my life swear off of watching any movie with me that might have a jump scare because I've been told, and laughingly and lightly, it makes me laugh too, that my startle has been scarier for them than whatever was going on in any kind of scary movie. And I do like scary movies. It's part of my high sensation seeker part. So it's not as direct as, oh, you're sensitive. You wouldn't see a scary movie. If you're high sensation seeking, you probably like that scariness to a point. I won't watch something too bloody. I won't watch anything depraved. Now, from working on integrating my nervous system from the fragmentation, my startle response is much, much lower than it used to be because of how I've worked on myself. Yes, it's true. I may have a bit of a startle response always, but it feels different in a way that's very hard to put into words or very hard for science to study in someone like me, even if science was interested in studying this dynamic. But my nervous system doesn't feel fried in a raw, traumatized way anymore. Often when I get startled now, I can giggle and laugh as my breath and my heartbeat comes back to me, whereas before I might erupt into tears or feel a strong sense of wanting to run out of the room because my flight or fight response, my voice might have gotten edgier, ready to fight. As sensitive people, we also tend to have a rich, complex inner life. There's not much I can say here other than, you know what I mean if you're highly sensitive. We have worlds within worlds going on inside of our minds, our dream spaces, our imaginations, vibrant worlds. Lots of us dream in color. What a gift to have a rich, complex inner life. This is also part of getting to know ourselves. If our self-love has been damaged by abuse or neglect, I would encourage you here to practice some real appreciation for the richness of your inner world. Even if you've gotten a lot of feedback that something is weird or bizarre or strange about that, you get to embrace it and love that about you. Now, here is a biggie, and it's pretty universal. We have a need for downtime. Now, what's tricky here is that this is also true of introverts. I am a very strong introvert. I can appear extroverted, which means I can appear ambiverted, but that's not really the truth of who I am. It wears me out big time. Not all highly sensitive people are introverts, believe it or not. We estimate the split is about 70-30. 30 being extroverted, highly sensitive people. I have loved working with my extroverted or ambiverted, highly sensitive people. The love of my life, producer of the show, Chris, is a highly sensitive ambivert. As sensitive people, we all, introverted or extroverted, wherever you fall on that spectrum, we all need to withdraw during busy days for privacy and relief from stimulation. It's important to know and accept this about high sensitivity, that we leave stimulation to recharge ourselves, to be able to go back into the world that can be so overstimulating. Now, you will know lots of people from the group of average people, that 80 to 85%, who do not need maybe ever to recharge in such a way. If you try to be like other people that are not wired like you are, you're just going to be down on yourself and your critical voice is going to love it. If you're a highly sensitive person, you're not like the rest of everybody else. If people around you expect you to be like they are and have the same needs, work on your own self-esteem, work on your own worth towards the cultivation of emotional and physical boundaries and great big permission for you to live as you instead of you trying to live as someone else. Do you hear how cuckoo-choo, that is. And that's how it feels when we try to live as someone else. No wonder it backfires. No wonder it doesn't work. Now, I'm not teaching boundaries this October in 2024, but I sure am in 2025. Boundaries are not something we learn in a minute or a moment, or we listen to one podcast about. Stay tuned and stay connected to my work if you want to be a part of that the next time I teach it. That's one that is not an evergreen course, and I'm in there live. Our nervous systems tend to feel frazzled. This necessitates time alone. This is part of this withdrawing from stimuli. In relationships, you will benefit from learning how to negotiate this in the light versus in the dark. Now, here's what I mean by that. When my husband and I were together, he leans more extroverted than I do. I needed to advocate for what I needed here, that I do need more withdrawal from stimuli, even from him, even though I love him very much and very much enjoy his company. It took a bit for him to not feel a bit put out, a bit insulted by me needing to be away from him. He had to learn how to not take that personally. And that is so understandable. Now that he understands this about me, it's easy peasy. I can say, hey, I'm overstimulated. He can go, got it. I'll go stick some headphones in and he'll go do something else and give me some space so my system can come back down to grounded, to less fried and frazzled, so that I can show up with my smiley best self and be fun and light, enjoyable, have energy to give to conversation or to a task or to an event or a social outing. This is very important to understand because mental health pathologizes withdrawal for almost everybody across the board without a distinction yet. For highly sensitive people being different than the average person. Withdrawal can look like avoidance. It can also become avoidance if you're not being honest with yourself about the difference between avoiding and recharging. This is important to understand and to do healthily. One of the big criteria of depression is withdrawal. I used to feel like I was failing, like I wasn't doing it right, like I couldn't quite get it or understand it. It made me feel crazy, frankly, to have therapists tell me that withdrawal meant I was depressed when that was the thing that helped me come back to myself. What a mixed message that did not serve me at all and pathologized the very thing that was helping me more than almost anything else. It takes an artful, insightful, nuanced therapist or healer to distinguish the difference between recharging and hiding or avoiding, and not making what you need as a highly sensitive person something wrong with you, something that is a clinical mental health diagnosis criteria. Here's another one that seems very specific and often shocks people to learn that this is almost universal in our tribe of highly sensitive people. We are annoyed and aggravated by being asked to do too many things at once. We're good at focusing, hyper-focusing sometimes, but because we're good at observing so much, it's very easy to have it seem like every single highly sensitive person has ADD. Then again, you're pathologized for your skill at observing, your sensitive skill. Someone tried to give me stimulant ADD meds once when I was younger. Now, all right, I could get things done. I could clean my house better than I could without it and stay on top of things. All the things that we want when we struggle with focus and distraction. But additionally, it did not work with my system. It made me feel like an aggravated, irritable animal that wanted to plow through the walls of my apartment and run down the street like a mad bull on the run. Judith Orloff, a doctor of psychiatry, teaches other psychiatrists how to minimally medicate highly sensitive people, if they even medicate highly sensitive clients at all, for reasons like I just gave. Dr. Orloff is a highly sensitive person herself, and is doing work to get our needs acknowledged by the medical community. She advocates for us in medicine, saying that we often benefit from a fraction of a medication that frankly does not make sense to the average prescribing medical professional out there. As a sensitive person, we might benefit from a fifth of the lowest dose, or even a tenth, or even the 20th of a dose, a fraction that seems inconsequential to the average person. This is another solid reason why I am wary about what science proves for the human condition. Because studies are done on the basic population, not on different populations, like our highly sensitive one. These are things that might be uncomfortable to know, might make navigating something like healthcare more difficult, or maybe even more of a bummer, or feel like there's another strike against us. Already sensitivity is hard. But if we don't know this, we can't appropriately, accurately, and effectively advocate for what we really need. We need to be able to stand on our own two feet and assertively tell service professionals about our sensitivities and see if they want to work with us through and around that, or if they just want to treat us like everybody else that's out there. All right, new category, sensory dislikes and avoidance strategies. So as sensitive people, we tend to try to avoid violent media and situations that are overwhelming or upsetting. But again, as a high sensation seeker, I can tell you this does not fit for me. Now, like I said earlier, I don't watch super, super dark or depraved things. I have a line. I like true crime, but when I watch true crime, my system isn't so much picking up the tragedy of it. I'm very highly attuned and aware of the resiliency of all the people around that crime, even when it is a murder. I get a lot of juice for life out of seeing, wow, that's how that mother who lost their child, that's how they went on. I get a lot of strength from that. That might sound dark to people who are purely highly sensitive and not high sensation seeking. And that's something inside of our tribe that we could do well to understand. Sometimes high sensation seekers get shamed by the non-high sensation seekers in our tribe. Like, oh no, something must be wrong with you if you like something like true crime. You can't possibly be sensitive if you like to be scared. I really love haunted houses too. So if we're more aware of this as a community, we don't have to do this to each other. And if you have someone in your life, even someone that you know is sensitive, that does that to you about your high sensation seeking, take care of yourself around that. Don't take it personally. It can be really confusing to figure out our high sensation seeking within ourselves. And then how to talk about it with other people is like a next level of self-understanding and expansion. We get to embrace our opposites. I don't much like the wind on my skin, though I have been working with my sensitivity to be able to build up more tolerance of wind on my skin, because I live now in a windy area. But also, I've loved jumping out of an airplane. I am trying to see if my husband will have that experience with me. For him, right now, it's still a hard no. That makes no sense on paper. It's why our psychology, our sensory system, it's so anti-logical sometimes. And I don't want anyone in our tribe to feel crazy trying to make sense of these pulls into these oppositional forces that don't make logical sense. Invite a balance here. I push it with certain things and pull back from others. I'm highly aware in how I live day to day. It's my lifestyle to have balance in the forefront, balance of all factors, not in an obsessive, paranoid way, but in a grounded, calm, permission-giving way that helps me take care of myself. When I backpack in the mountains, which means I carry a 38 to 50 pound bag on my back and go anywhere from 5 to 7 miles in a first day at higher altitudes than I'm used to living, even though I live at almost 9,000 feet now. It's hard. It's grueling. What balances me is that I'm in nature that restores me. So the pack and the effort depletes me, but in a good, accomplished way of working my body out. And what balances me, what balances that bodily exertion, is the spiritual restoration that I get from nature, from sleeping under the stars, from being far away from humanity, because I'm sleeping in a place where cars can't even get to. We each come to our own unique ways to balance that work for us through trial and error. We tend to have a disrupted concentration or a disrupted mood when we're very hungry. So if we're sensitive, of course, food is going to be a big deal. Mostly what I eat now is about 80 to 90% of a lion diet of all grass-fed or humanely raised meat and seafood. And this has gotten me and my system off of the blood sugar roller coaster of a typical American diet. This has helped me tremendously to feel more grounded, less thrown by those highs and lows of food consumption. As highly sensitive people, we do well to make it a priority to arrange our lives around our sensitivity. Now, we can't always do that, and inconveniencing other people to high heaven is not the way. But we want to keep it in the forefront. We want to give ourselves permission to make our sensitive systems a priority. It's our own one precious life. Why wouldn't we? It's okay to want to avoid upsetting or overwhelming situations. That's super reasonable. We just can't avoid them all. It's why we avoid some, so that we have the juice for life when we are in an upsetting or overstimulating, overwhelming situation. This is more than a priority in my life. This is my value system. I have a necessary awareness so that I can embody real, grounded, actual self-care. We're bothered by intense stimuli and chaotic scenes. I'm currently writing one of the most difficult moments of my life when I press charges against my adoptive dad. What's coming out of me as I write is the overstimulation of it, being in the police station for 12 full hours straight. The subject matter itself, wildly overstimulating, the stress of it absolutely frying me out, but also the sterility of the police station, the smell of cheap chemical cleaners, the fluorescent lights, the supposed victims' advocates that were so inadequate they didn't even advocate that we take a break after being questioned again and again and again for a 12-hour marathon. I was so bothered by overstimulation that I was enraged, my nervous system in hard fight or flight. I wanted to fight everyone and everything and was having an incredibly hard time holding onto myself and not just panicking and running out of the room down the street. Intensity of a situation or event, the possibility of overstimulation is at the forefront of my mind, so that I can make the best choices for myself. I no longer attend loud music shows, but I will see reggae or bluegrass or jazz or classical, because those are easier for my body and mind to process and feel and enjoy without totally frying me out. Now I'm going to stop here and I'm going to finish the rest of this episode about high sensitivity as our exclusive Patreon episode for this month. Every month on Patreon, we have exclusive content that you never, ever, ever get to hear or watch on YouTube, anywhere else. It's only on Patreon. It's not on our website. It's also a place where I can be a little bit more intimate with what I share and how I interact. And if you're on Patreon, getting exclusive episodes, you're right there ready to throw in a question to our next live stream Q&A. The next live stream Q&A, it's always on the second Wednesday of the month, is on narcissism. Come ask your questions. You can ask any kind of question. If you have a question inside of you that some part of you says, "Ooh, I'm not supposed to ask this question," I am here for it. I am the person that you can ask. I am inviting it. Sometimes sensitive people have fears because many of us were raised by narcissistic dynamics. So we learned them, we saw them, they happened in front of us. There's a big difference between soaking up somebody else's personality disordered behavior versus having that personality disorder yourself. If you have questions or there is something that I can share to help you on your journey, make peace with who you are, or take care of yourselves around the rampant narcissism that is growing in our society, please come support us on the Patreon. It's patreon.com/emotionalbadass. You'll also get the biggest discount to Emotional Strength Training 30 Days to Peace that is starting on the first of the month. You have every right to learn what it really truly is to embrace your true self and never ever again try to tell yourself or your inner child that what's right in the world is for you to be like everybody else. You get to be you. And let me take that further. The world needs you. Your beautiful observation, your way of looking at the world is going to make me cry. There's my sensitivity. We see beauty in the world. We notice things that delight. You don't need to be less sensitive. You get to walk the world showing the world the power, the strength, the beauty of sensitivity, and never, ever, ever again walk with an energy of apology for who you are, whether that's inside of yourself or out there for the world. You count, you matter, and the world needs our insights. Come hang out with me more on Patreon. I'll see y'all for the rest of this episode on our exclusive Patreon episode, and I'll see the rest of you for a brand new episode next week. Emotional Badass is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. I am an emotional badass. You are an emotional badass. And together, we are where moxie meets mindful. Light and love and embracing of our sensitivity. Take care and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
At a time when change is constant and we are pulled in far too many directions, we need a way to stay present to life and to increase our ability to remain calm, think clearly, and maintain our well-being. Many studies indicate mindfulness improves our mental, emotional, and physical health. On A Mindful Moment with Teresa McKee, you can learn how to practice mindfulness and enjoy its many benefits. Tune in for guided meditations and to hear tips and advice from some of the most respected experts in the fields of mental health and mindfulness. The world truly can be a better place. It all starts with a mindful moment.